We're taking a journey through the life of Jesus, taking this journey through his life. As most of you know, we started it back in December for the Christmas season with the birth of Jesus, and we're slow walking through. We are not in a hurry to get through the life of Jesus. We took 2 years to go through the Old Testament, and that was kind of rushed to do that. But we're slowing it down to go through Jesus' life because he's kind of the reason we're here every Sunday, isn't it? So we're going to take our time. And we're early on. And last week, we saw three miracles that Jesus did early in his ministry. And so today, we are going to look at a sermon that he preached. Here's why. And I told you this before, I'll remind you today, that when Jesus did miracles, it drew a crowd. Those signs brought attention. People would come to Jesus to hear what he had to say. Because if he could work miracles, maybe he was the promised Messiah, or at least he was in touch with God. They wanted to hear his message. So the crowds came for the miracles, and they would stick around for the teaching. And we're going to observe one such case together this morning, beginning in Matthew chapter 5 and verse 1. It says, "One day, as he saw the crowds gathering, Jesus went up on the mountainside and sat down. His disciples gathered around him, and he began to teach them." Now, what's going to happen next is a very large collection of Jesus' teaching on this spot. And this passage right here will be called the Sermon on the Mount. How many are you familiar with that term before? You know the Sermon on the Mount, okay? That's a term you're familiar with. Jesus is going to give the sermon from the mountainside to the gathered crowds. Now, I want to say a few things by way of introduction today. This is no doubt not the only time Jesus taught these things. He no doubt brought these things wherever he went, all over the place, and taught them repeatedly. We do that today in modern times. We still bring our messages elsewhere when we travel. Jesus would see the people who would only hear him possibly once. He taught these things probably everywhere he went. There's many times in the Bible where it simply says that Jesus taught the people without telling us what he taught them. And this is the kind of stuff he taught them. And other stuff, other parables that we'll see down the road. But the Sermon on the Mount is probably a collection of his broad teachings. In fact, Luke gives us an example of a parallel set of teaching Jesus did a different time, same content. So his disciples heard it over and over again, no doubt. But Matthew records it here in what we call the Sermon on the Mount. And it's long. It's three chapters long. Matthew 5, 6, and 7. Now, it's not that long to read it. You can read it in less than 15 minutes if you just read it, like 12 minutes to read all three chapters, depending on how fast you read. But Jesus didn't teach it in 15 minutes. In fact, he didn't even teach it in the sense of what we do at church. In modern times like today, modern American church, we get in our nice cars, we drive to the church house, we hop out for a 45-minute sermon, a couple songs sprinkled in here and there, and some pats on the back to our friends, and then we go home. In those days, people would travel sometimes a long way through difficulty to gather for an event. Maybe the only time that Jesus would be in their area, or it would be so rare that they would gather when they could, and it would be an all-day affair. There's stories where Jesus would stop and feed the crowds because there were so many people all day long. So Jesus is going to teach the things in the Sermon on the Mount at a much more drawn-out clip. Matthew is simply summarizing his major points in these chapters, but Jesus would expound on them at great length, no doubt. And he covers a lot of topics. So we decided, how are we going to teach the Sermon on the Mount this time as we journey through the life of Jesus? Now, many years ago when I was a younger man and our church models were different in my background, we used to do church like 3 or 4 times a week, lots of sermons every week. And in those days, I spent one service a week teaching through the Sermon on the Mount, one verse or two verses at a time. It took us like a year to get through the whole sermon. We are not going to do that this time. Some of you are probably glad. Maybe not. I don't know. Then we could also do the opposite and literally fly over the Sermon on the Mount in one quick week. Like just fly over it and say, here's what they talk about and be done today. We're not going to do that either. We're going to take a handful of weeks. We have up to 8 weeks that we've chosen to take. We might not take all of them. I have said all along that we're not going to teach every single miracle, everything Jesus said in this series. We'll do most of it, but as I've told you all along, read the Bible for yourself. It's all in there. We're going to hit the high points. So in this message, we are going to go ahead and begin a handful of weeks covering the major themes of this famous sermon. And believe me, they're not all the same theme. Like Jesus pivots, like they take a break for coffee or something, and he changes gears and talks about something else and talks about something else in this day of teaching. We'll cover one of those themes today. We'll come back to some other ones in the next few weeks, and then we'll move on. But let's begin the Sermon on the Mount. And let's begin. I'm setting the stage right now. It's our first week. Let me say this also. There were different kinds of people gathered to hear Jesus. Who was in the crowd? Well, his disciples were there. They were always there. They probably could have recited it verbatim after about 30 times he gave it. The disciples were there, but there were also the religious leaders and the Pharisees who would show up not because they loved Jesus, not because they liked him, but because they wanted to find fault, because they had their religious system of how we do God. And everyone, so even today we have people who get religious and this is how we do God. This is the right and the wrong way. And, you know, so many opinions. And so the religious crowd of that day would come and say, we're in charge around here. We know how we do the God thing. And Jesus did not fit into the box. So they would sit there and cross their arms and look for fault. And they're there. And Jesus will address them in the sermon, but not at the beginning, not today. The majority of the people who came to hear Jesus, however, the majority of the people were just regular folks like you and me, people who are struggling to make it work in their everyday life, just struggling to get by, people who try to pay their bills and work hard, grind day and night to make a living while Rome taxed them to death and the temple system tithed them to death. And they're just trying to get through it all, to make it all work and take care of themselves and wonder, where do we stand with God? No doubt the people in Jesus' crowd, like us today sometimes, they wondered where they stood with God. Because life wasn't always easy, does that mean that God doesn't favor us? Perhaps they feared that they were in a bad place before God. And the religious leaders with their arms crossed would probably agree. Yes, you're the sinners over there, not righteous like us. You are in a bad place with God. Most of the religious leaders were very wealthy and in power and control. They seem to be favored. And the regular folks might be saying, I don't know what to think. So they're showing up to hear Jesus teach. And Jesus is going to tell them that God sees things differently. He's going to challenge them. They want to know what he has to say. And so Jesus is going to begin this famous sermon in the first section of topics by giving us what we call, in modern day church, we call them the Beatitudes. How many know that term, the Beatitudes? Okay? Beatitudes. That's a very big word you'll never use again unless you're talking about the Bible. Okay. There are a list of things that Jesus says that God blesses. And we're going to look at all of them today. There's 8 or 9 of them today. We're going to look at all of them. And they're all like different topics, so we're going to be like yanking the steering wheel all over the road today, okay? Because we're going to see all of them today. But here's the overarching big idea. All of these blessings that God, that Jesus mentions, are counterintuitive. They're counterintuitive. Because they show us how God sees things, and God sees things differently than we do. What Jesus is going to teach us is simply this, that it is better to be the right person than to be in the right position. Now, we like to be in the right position, the position of power, the position of wealth, the position of control, the position of influence, the position of whatever. And again, some people in the nation, the religious elites definitely were. But for most people, they were not in the right position. They were in the struggling position. And so when you're in that position of life, you look around and say, we're losing. I'm tired of losing. I want to be winning. But Jesus is trying to say to them, listen, don't look at the scoreboard as this world keeps score. Don't pay attention to the world's scoreboard because we're playing a completely different game. And it's better to be the right person than to be in the right position in God's eyes. And so we're going to see that through each of these things. Now, let's get into the list. I'm going to tell you right now, I could spend an entire Sunday talking about each one of them. I'm going to glance at them. I'm not going to be thorough. But I want us to get a smattering of what Jesus is talking about with this big idea right here. Let's begin with verse 3. God blesses those who are poor and realize their need for him, for the kingdom of heaven is theirs. Now, I don't know how blessed you feel when you're poor. That's definitely counterintuitive. Like, I'm tired of being poor. Jesus, no offense to your sermon here. I'm tired of being poor. I'm tired of being so aware of how much I need you. It'd be nice once in a while to not need you quite so badly. It'd be nice once in a while to not be so much in dire need all the time, to be able to say, I got this for a change. And don't take me wrong. You can be rich and know you need God. You can be poor and not even pay attention to God. But what Jesus is saying is he's making a contrast that we think the better situation is to be well off. But he says if you're poor, but you're aware of your need for him, you're better off than if you didn't feel you did. And God blesses that. You know, feel blessed at the moment, but he says the kingdom of heaven is theirs. Now, the promise at the end, the kingdom of heaven is theirs. Every one of these beatitudes Jesus is going to give us end with a promise, and most of them say the word will be. You will be blessed. But in the beginning and the end, he mentions the kingdom of heaven is theirs. That is also a will be promise also. You will be blessed. But he also is saying it's yours now. God blesses those who are in a position where they never forget that we need him. Let me go to the second one. Ready? Verse 4. God blesses those who mourn, for they will be comforted. Most of us would not look at mourning, grieving, as a blessing. If God was blessing us, we'd have nothing to mourn about. We'd have nothing to grieve over, right? Life would just be perfect. In fact, today in our modern culture, we sometimes will say, if I'm going through bad times, maybe God's not there. In those days, they said, I know God's there. I just wonder if he cares. But here's the thing. As we grieve through life, God never promised. There's no theology. There's no theological framework that says life is without heartache. Quite the opposite. In fact, if you've ever been given a theology in church that says if you do the right things, everything will turn out the way you want them all the time, you probably got burned and walked away from church at some point when that didn't work out right. That's a very faulty view of God. The truth is, in love, God gave us life. He created everything, gave us life. In love, he gave us freedom to choose, free will. And we've taken that and we've abused it to death, right? And because of our freedoms, we have done what's self-serving. We've harmed ourselves. We've harmed our planet. We've harmed other people. We have not cared. And not just our ancestors before us, but us today. The whole world has been affected by the stain of sin and suffering, and sin brings death, and we all experience it. And so but that's part of God's gift. God in his love gave life. God in his love gave us freedom to make those choices. And God in his love sent his son to redeem us. But here's the deal. As we walk through life, part of living is hurting. Part of living is dying. Part of loving is losing. It's just the part of having the gift of life means we get the whole caboodle. The good, the bad, and the ugly, and if we live, we will experience all of it. And that's part of the privilege of being alive, is all the hurt that comes with living. And so, God doesn't promise to bless us by never causing us grief, having us grieve. What God promises is that when we mourn, when we grieve, God blesses us. In other words, God sees us. God sees us when we grieve. And we will be comforted. We will be comforted. It reminds me of an Old Testament promise in the book of Psalms, chapter 46, where the psalmist said that God is our refuge and our strength. He is a very present help when we are in trouble. What does that mean? Well, here's what I think it means. When my kids were growing up, and now that they're pretty much all grown, when my kids were growing up, there was times when through the years they were running around the house, we're all doing our own thing, we're working on this project, we're relaxing, doing this. We're all in the same house, but we're not in each other's faces, you know? We're all living our own lives. But when one of my kids got hurt physically and they're crying, or they got emotionally hurt and they're crying, guess where I was? I was right there. Are you okay? I'm paying attention. What's going on? How can I help? I was always there, but I was really there. That's what the scriptures say, that God is a very present help when we're in trouble. That when you're mourning, when you go through the life experience that we all will experience of grief and loss because it's part of living, when those times come and you think, man, is God even there? Why am I going through hard times? Jesus is like, oh, God is not only there, he's extra there. He's extra close. He sees you. He's with you. And you might not feel the comfort today because it's a grieving process and comfort can't take the pain away. But as time goes on, you'll see that God was with you and you will be comforted. Let's keep moving on. We gotta hurry along. Verse 5. God blesses those who are humble, for they will inherit the whole earth. Now, humble people don't seem to be in charge of the world today, do they? You know who runs the world today? You know who runs the world, don't you? Stubborn people. Stubborn people run the proud, stubborn people run everything. You know why? Because everyone else just figures out how to get things done around them. Because they ain't gonna cooperate, you know? So they get their way, it feels like. It's a bad deal. And everyone else just figures out how to make things work despite the proud and stubborn ones and just keep things going forward. It doesn't feel like winning, does it, when you're humble? But God says they will inherit the whole earth. God says, I'm blessing a different metric. And that's what I'm looking for, the humble. Let's keep moving. We can spend so much time on each of these. Verse 6, God blesses those who hunger and who thirst for justice, for they will be satisfied. The word justice or righteousness there, for what is right, what is just. We should all want justice. Now, if I'm being honest in my flesh, you know what I want? Not justice, I want my agenda. I want things to go my way. If it isn't just for somebody else, I mean, them's the breaks, you know? I've learned this when I play sports. I've learned that when I play sports, that, when I watch sports, that if I'm watching two teams play sports and they're not my team, I want a just called game. I want the refs to be fair. I want it close. But when my teams are playing, I want all the calls to go my way. And if they don't, someone's cheating me, you know? So that's how we operate, right? And so in life, justice is, well, let me get ahead. Let me get some extra lucky breaks. And then everyone else can have some justice after that, as long as I'm coming out with my agenda and my wish list. And so it's very hard for us to care about what's best for people because we often care about what's best for us. And yet we often say what's best for people is what's best. Even if it's not best for me, what's best for people is what's best. And justice says, I don't want to see any injustice in the world. I want righteousness to reign. I want right to prevail. What's going on around me that's not right? Let's have righteousness prevail. Let's have a better world. And the idea of hungering and thirsting for it. Hunger and thirst means you desire it, but it's not satisfied yet. Otherwise, you wouldn't be hungry or thirsty anymore. It means you're actively, when you're hungry, what do? You look for food. You look for drink. That is somebody who's pursuing the idea of justice. That I want justice. And I'm certainly not going to cause injustice for my own benefit, but I want to find justice elsewhere, and I crave it. And Jesus says, God blesses that outlook, and you will be satisfied. Let's keep going. Verse 7. God blesses those who are merciful, for they will be shown mercy. Merciful is hard. It's hard to be merciful. You know why? Because if you're being merciful, it means somebody needs it. And we're like, Arlen, they don't deserve mercy. Here's the beautiful truth about mercy. You only need it when you don't deserve it. If someone didn't need mercy, it wouldn't be a conversation. Being merciful means someone needs it. And God blesses those who are merciful. See, when someone hurts us, we'd like to be bitter. Jesus says, forgive. We'd like to get revenge, get our pound of flesh. Jesus says, show mercy. And we all love mercy. We all love mercy for us. I love mercy for me. We'll sing about mercy. We'll preach about mercy. We'll hope in mercy. We'll celebrate a God who is merciful. And yet, Jesus says, be merciful as your Father in heaven is merciful. God blesses those who are merciful, and they will be shown mercy. By the way, that's just, God's always saying that. Like, you set the stage. How do we play this game? You want mercy? Be a merciful person. Show us how the rules of your life will work. Number next, God blesses those whose hearts are pure, for they will see God. It's hard to keep our hearts pure. This world can knock the purity right out of our hearts. Or the, can I use the word innocence? Takes the innocence right away. Like when we're young, you know, that childlike innocence and faith about things, and we're idealistic almost. And then life, if we're not careful, will leave us jaded. And instead of being an idealistic person, we'll be an opportunistic person saying, you know what? That don't work in this world. All that mumbo jumbo about do the right thing and trust God. I got to do what's best for me. It's a dog-eat-dog world. I'm going to get my way. I've got to fight for my stuff. And we can become worldly, pursue the things that we want in this life and lose that innocence, lose that purity of heart because life leaves us jaded. But God blesses those whose hearts stay pure. And they will see God. And that means a lot of things. But I think one application, if I could give it, is that when your heart is pure, you're able to see God where you won't see it from a jaded perspective. When you have a heart that stays pure, when people do things, instead of seeing just the bad, like our jaded nature wants to see, you'll say, I see some good in there. When your hearts are pure and bad things happen, you'll not just see the bad things cynically. You'll say, God's at work in those bad things. Here's an example for you. Joseph in the Bible. Joseph was a kid with a pure little dream world of God's blessing. Everyone's going to support me one day. You remember the story? And then he got taken through the ringer by his brothers and then he was a slave and the owners treated him bad. He was in a bad deal for 13 years. But when it all came down, his heart was still tender. He was emotional. He cried when he saw his family someday after all that had happened. It was deep. But he was kind to them, and he said to them through tears, what you meant for evil, God brought good out of it. That I see God in all the things in life, because I didn't lose that along the way. Let's keep going. Ready? I love verse 9. Verse 9 is so good. God blesses those who work for peace, for they will be called the children of God. I grew up hearing that as God blesses the peacemakers. Which I thought was a missile, I don't know. But God blesses those who work for peace. They will be called the children of God. What does that mean? Well, working for peace could mean working for peace between you and me. You and me are at conflict, right? But instead of, I'm gonna find peace with you. And that's a good application, that is. But that kind of fits under the merciful application earlier. Like, I'm merciful to you and you're wrong to me. I think this is talking about just beyond my own problems with you. I'm looking at people everywhere and I'm saying, I want to find peace between people. I want peace on earth to be more than a beauty pageant slogan. Peace, world peace is a great idea. How can I bring peace to my world? It's hard to do that because we have a world that thrives on drama. Drinks it up like it's Kool-Aid. Drama. You know what gossip is? You know what gossip is? Gossip is throwing fuel on a fire. No, actually, gossip is sometimes starting the fire and then throwing fuel on it. Some people love to see people at odds and pit them. You see people sometimes who will be at odds with somebody else, and when they're at odds with somebody else, they like to rally their little group of friends extra tight, like be extra good to them so everyone will feel close, so they have teams against their ops, you know? Or they'll have these controversies. They want to see people at odds with each other, so they gossip and they spread stuff and they pop the popcorn and watch the rule burn. Being a peacemaker is hard. Working for peace is hard. You know what that means? It means I got to go over here and I got to figure out how to get people to get along. So, who should I pick on? I'm going to pick on somebody here. And I was like, don't look at me. I'll pick on you. You see where you are? Miguel, I'm going to pick on you. I'm going to pick on Mike Burdick. You guys know each other now. You're both in the same little group here. So here's the thing. These two guys are at odds. They're not like each other. There's no peace between them. And I want to work for peace between me and everybody, but they're not at peace with each other. You know what the temptation for me to do is? To stay in each of their good graces and let them hate each other. Like if I'm with Miguel and he's like, oh, that Mike, I'll tell you. I'm like, yeah, I know. Hey, just don't be, because I don't want him mad at me. If he's mad at me, you know what's going to happen? He's going to give me the same treatment he's given Mike. So, hey, I'm with you. And Mike's, he's the worst, absolutely. But, hey, we're good, buddy. And then I'm with Mike later. I'm like, oh, hey, Mike. Yeah. Miguel, you know what he's been saying about you? I'm just saying. But, hey, I'm Team Mike, you know. And we'll just play it both ways because we want to stay out of it. We want to stay clean. You know what's hard to do is to go to Miguel and say, now, hold on now. I know what you're saying, but listen, he's a good man. And you know what? I think we're giving him the worst outlook. Maybe he didn't mean that. And we're going to Mike and we're saying, Mike, I heard Miguel say something good about you. You know? And I think there's a... I want to bring things together. No one wants to do that. Have you ever seen two people fighting and you run up in the middle and try and stop the fight? What happens to the person who runs in the middle of a fight and tries to stop it? What happens? Sometimes you get a hit, don't you? So you know, you're like, I'm just going to stay back and eat popcorn. But God blesses those who work for peace, who are peacemakers. It's a dangerous job. But when we do that, Jesus says, you'll be called the children of God. Now that can mean a whole lot of things. Can I give you one application real quick here? One application is this, and this is not my opinion. If you'll read the rest of Matthew 5, you'll see that Jesus teaches this very thing later on. Here's one of the applications that it means. It means that when you do work for peace, when you're a peacemaker, you resemble your Father in heaven. You ever been somewhere where someone says, man, you look like your mom or you look like your dad? Or when you did that, when you laughed that way or when you did that good deed, it reminded me of your father or your mother. I see the resemblance. I know whose child you are. And when we are working for peace, we might take a couple shots along the way, but people will stop and say, that looks familiar. That's the child of God. That's how God is. There's a resemblance there. And again, we'll see that context a different week some time later. Work for peace. We're almost done. A couple more. Ready? Verse 10. God blesses those who are persecuted for doing right. No one wants to be persecuted for doing right. What does that look like? Well, have you ever been at a job where all the people at your job were doing the wrong thing, but you wouldn't participate? Or maybe your friend's circle or your neighborhood circle, and they're all doing something wrong, but you're like, no, I can't do that. No one likes that person. Or you're the only one who's doing something right, and no one else is doing that. And like, who do you think you are? You're better than us? You know, when you do right, something about humanity, we get so insecure about ourselves that when someone else is doing something right that we're not doing or not doing something wrong that we are doing, we get so critical of them because we're insecure, we tear them down. And people who do right are oftentimes looked down upon, made fun of, dismissed, shunned for doing right. It's like, well, I'm trying to do the right thing. Why don't you love me? That's how it works, man. And Jesus says, God blesses that. I don't feel blessed. That's the point. But the kingdom of heaven is theirs. Again, all of this list is promises. God will do this for you. You will be comforted. You will be called the children of God. You will be shown mercy. You will be satisfied. You will inherit the whole earth. But here again, he says, the kingdom of heaven is yours. That's both a will be promise for later, but also right now, you're living in a kingdom mindset in this world, and God is blessing that. And he expounds further. One more, ready? Same idea, but deeper. Verse 11. God blesses you when people mock you and persecute you and lie about you and say all sorts of evil things against you because you're my followers. How many of us today want to sign up for that fun party right there? Oh, yeah. Lie about me. Say all sorts of evil things about me. I love that. Persecute me. Woo! Right? That's not fun. And Jesus says God's blessing you when you do that because you follow Jesus. When because you follow Jesus, it costs you something. Now, in our current culture, we don't experience the worst of that, do we? There are parts of the world and parts of history where people were put to death for following Jesus. There are places today where people are put in prison for following Jesus. Most of us, the price we pay is someone doesn't want to be our friend, or they look down on us, or say some cutting things, or pick at our lives to find fault because we make them uncomfortable, or they leave us out. I mean, but either way, whenever you feel like you're on the outs because of your following Jesus, that's not fun. And Jesus says God blesses that. In fact, he says even more, verse 12. He says, be happy about it. What? Oh yeah, be very glad, he says. How do you be happy about being treated that way for doing right? And Jesus says, for a great reward awaits you in heaven. There's another will be. A great reward is awaiting you in heaven. It might not feel good right now, but we ain't done with the story yet. And you will be rewarded. And then he adds one extra layer. He says, and remember, the ancient prophets were persecuted in the same way. You know what that means, don't you? That means that well, here's what he's saying. In old times, the people who came before us that we idolize as great heroes of the faith or whatever, ancient prophets, in their day, they weren't always popular. Just history was kind to them. The very people sometimes, even in Jesus' day, the same people who celebrated the prophets and lifted up the prophets of old, had they been alive in their lifetime, would have not liked them and have mistreated them. And Jesus says, when you do right and you get persecuted for it, you're in a special fraternity. You're in a good group, and God's going to reward that. Your reward awaits you in heaven, but also you belong to a special fraternity now of those who've ever suffered for doing what's right. And folks, that is the Beatitudes. We just covered them all. Now, we didn't cover them all. I did this last time years and years ago, like 9 weeks worth right there. We flew over them all. And I know that as you look at those, some of you would say, well, I like that one. That was a good one. Or I like those two. Some of them, you're like, I don't even understand that one. You didn't help me understand it better, Arlen. Thanks a lot. Or maybe a couple of them, you don't even like them. You're like, you know what? I don't even like that one. I disagree with that. That's fine. That's your faith journey. That's you and God. You work that out as we accept that Jesus, here's what Jesus is telling us. All of this is counterintuitive. Jesus points out things that most people would view as negative and as proof of God's judgment, or at least God's lack of approval or lack of blessing. But Jesus insists these are actually the things that God is using and blessing and working through to bring about God's ultimate goal. So they're counterintuitive because we want all the opposite of that stuff. Never to grieve or mourn, not to be poor, not to need God so badly, to get our way. To get back at people when they wrong us. To do right, not be persecuted for it. To not have to fight to make peace. All that nonsense. And Jesus says, this is how I see the world. And what he's saying, once again, is this. It's better to be the right person than to be in the right position. We all want to be in the position of power, of wealth, of control, of influence, of the places where we feel like we're winning. We strive to be in those positions in life. And Jesus says, hey, if that comes your way, great. But that's not something to strive for. Strive to be the right person instead. Because it's better to be the right person than to be in the right position. You're like, yeah, but if I'm not in the right position, it just kind of feels like I'm losing. And other people are winning, and why are they winning? Again, stop looking at the scoreboard that the world keeps, that the world measures. Because we're playing a completely different game here. This is kingdom mindset. This is kingdom thinking. And so maybe you're here today, say, okay, Arlen, that's good. I got it. I like some, others I've got questions about, but I get the idea. It's better to be the right person than in the right position. But Arlen, good information. What do I do with it? Because some of us have a bias for action. We're like, tell me what to do. Give me some action steps, right? So if you want to know what to do, here's my advice. Do what Jesus said God blesses in that list. There's the action. Do what Jesus says God blesses. What does Jesus say God blesses? What should you do? Well, you can remember your need for God. Whether you're rich or poor, on top of the world or underneath the mountain yourself, hey, remember your need for God. We sing the song, don't we? I need you, Lord. I need you every hour. I need you. I mean, remember your need for God. Never get past the point where we realize how much we need him. What should we do? We should grieve as needed. It's okay to hurt. That's part of living. If you're going to live, you're going to hurt. You can't take life and not expect to have heartache throughout. And it's different for all of us, but Jesus says, grieve as needed. God is close to you when that happens. It's okay to hurt, and you are loved, and you will be comforted. What do? We stay humble. And even though we feel successful and accomplished, we want to move ahead, stay humble. Or as the Saint Tim McGraw once said, be humble and kind, right? Just stay humble in your life. It's important. What do? We pursue justice. That's what we do. Pursue justice. Look for what's wrong in the world. Never perpetuate injustice for personal benefit. And look to solve and cure injustices elsewhere. Hunger for it, thirst for it, and pursue what is right. What can you do? You can show mercy. They don't deserve it. That's the idea. But if we want mercy, if we believe mercy is a big ideal that benefits us, we should pass it along. Show mercy. What can we do? You can keep your heart pure. This world can leave us jaded. Don't let it happen. Keep that faith, that childlike innocence in God that trusts him and sees him working in everything around us and doesn't get pulled into the ways of this world and what's best for me, but keeps our eyes on Jesus and his kingdom first. Keep our hearts pure. What can we do? We can work for peace. Work for peace. Be a peacemaker. You say, Arlen, I'd rather just sit back and gossip and cause drama. It's more fun to throw gasoline on the fire than it is to put out the fire. You know the problem with putting out fires, by the way, right? If you get too close to the fire to put it out, it might get burned. But be a peacemaker anyhow. Work for peace. What can we do? Well, let's let God's view be what drives you. Let God's view be what drives you. In other words, don't worry about the people who, if you do the right thing, they will persecute you. If you follow Jesus, they will mistreat you, and you don't want them to be mistreating you, or you don't want them to look down on you. You don't want them to unfriend you. You don't want them to walk away from you. You want their approval, so you do what they want rather than what's right. And I say, don't do that. Let God's view be what drives you. People can think whatever they want to think, but we want to hear God say, well done. I'm well pleased. And that's what should drive us. And that's a counterintuitive list, but it's a good one. And the Sermon on the Mount is going to continue, and it's going to pivot to a whole different topics. So buckle up, we got more to talk about. But for today, I hope that all of us can look at that list and take one or two out. Someone in the last hour told me, she's got a big job at her office in her company, and she said, I'm going to go home, take the list of things at the end there, and I'm going to write them on my whiteboard in my office, and this week I'm going to pray over all of them that God will help me live those out. That's a great thing to do. Wherever you are, here's what I want to ask you to do. Focus more on being the right person than being in the right position. Let's live the kind of lives that Jesus says is blessed by God.